So I know that I've met many of you, whether at a Jewish Studies event or a Historical Society event. I'll introduce myself all the same. I'm Mark Swick, and it is a distinct pleasure to serve as the Executive Director of the Jewish Historical Society of South Carolina. Can y'all hear me? The microphone I'll give our speaker in a minute will be much louder, so I'll try to eat this one until then. It really is my pleasure to introduce, and not, I don't think for the first time, I believe I've introduced him before, Steve Whitfield, who's our next presenter. Stephen J. Whitfield is Max Richter Professor Emeritus of American Civilization at Brandeis University, and he holds a bachelor's degree from Tulane University. He had some good recollections with our Historical Society President Jeff Rosenblum last night. They were fraternity brothers. You guys can joke about that again a little bit later. Trained as a historian, he first encountered the field of American studies when he had to teach it, beginning in the fall of 1972 at Brandeis. His curricular and research interests are primarily in the intersection of politics and ideas in the 20th century. Whitfield has twice been awarded Fulbright visiting professorships, first at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in 83 and 84, and then at the Catholic University of Louvain and Louvain-la-Neuve, excuse me, in Belgium, in the fall of 1993. And for a semester in 2004, he became the first Alans visiting professor at the Ludwig Maximilian University at Munich to offer courses in American Jewish studies. Very thankfully, Steve joins us this morning, not for all of those things. In addition to all of those things, he is also a tremendous scholar of Southern Jewish merchants, and that is what you'll be hearing about today. Steve's joined us before for Historical Society meetings, for Jewish Studies program meetings, and it is really my pleasure to introduce him this morning. Please join me in welcoming Steve Whitfield.
Thank you, Mark, for that introduction. I do want to thank Mark in particular for the introduction and for inviting me back. He mentioned that I've been here before. Mark is virtually the only program person I've ever dealt with in a series of opportunities to speak to various audiences. Mark is virtually the only one who's ever invited me back. I do very much want to thank him for that particular privilege. He also mentioned that President Rosenblum and I go back basically to 1962-63 when we were fraternity brothers in AEPI at Tulane. But I was shocked to realize that so far back that when I tried to give him the fraternity's secret handshake, he had not remembered it. And I'm not at liberty to reveal it here. That's only 1 second. Anyway, Southerners, both black and white, can be forgiven for suspecting the jury means business. The enterprises the Jews established in the region must have seemed ubiquitous. Thomas Jefferson, for example, patronized the dry goods store, that David Isaacs owned on the main street of Charlottesville. Isaacs sold him groceries and provided the endlessly curious Sage of Monticello with pamphlets on Judaism. And even before other framers had ratified the Constitution, Daniel Boone was dealing with a pair of Richmond merchants, Jacob Cohen and Isaiah Isaacs, whose receipts were written in Yiddish. Selling everything from frying pans to medicines to artificial flowers, the duo even hired Boone to survey some tracts. The enterprise of Cohen and Isaacs was commonly called the Jew Store. By the late 19th century, however, the names of such establishments became less generic and tended to brandish names of their proprietors. And in the first half of the 20th century, no city seemed to be without an emporium that testified to its Jewish origins. Such monuments to material desire and need could not be missed. In Richmond, it was Thalheimer's. In Baltimore, Hecht's, as well as Hutzler Brothers. In the nation's capital, Garfinkel's. In Memphis, Goldsmith's. In Little Rock, Gus Glass. In St. Louis, the May Company. In Birmingham, Bizitzes. In Dallas, Neiman Marcus. In Houston, Sackowitzes. In New Orleans, Godshaws. In Jacksonville, Cohen Brothers, as well as Birchgott's. In Savannah, Levy's. In Atlanta, Rich's. Their Jewish providence is almost as predictable as going to Italian towns and seeing that the houses of worship are Catholic. In 1890, an immigrant from Prussia named Solomon Lipinski founded a fashion-conscious store in Asheville and gave the department store the fancy name of Beaumarchais. At the age of 24, the most famous novelist that the city produced visited Paris. And later, Thomas Wolfe wrote to Lipinski's son, Louis, that, quote, I could not get used to the fact that they had a Beaumarchais. I kept wondering what the hell they were doing with our name. Far from such metropolises, anthropologists and sociologists who studied small southern towns could not help stumbling across Jews stocking inventory and seeking customers. Take the most thoroughly rural state of the former Confederacy. In the Natchez of a book called Deep South, quote, the wholesale merchants who once rivaled the banks as credit agencies for planters were, with one exception, Jews, end of quote. Had the anthropologists gone to Hattiesburg, they would have discovered that its downtown was no different, and that the Jews owned six clothing stores and a shoe store in Hattiesburg, all located on the same side of the street. In the Indianola, one of the classic books of ethnography cast in class in a southern town, published in 1937 by author John Dollard, the seven department stores on the main street, he said, were almost entirely owned by Jews. According to local wisdom in Indianola, if there is a Jewish holiday, you cannot buy a pair of socks in the whole country. These frustrated customers meant, of course, an annual Jewish holiday, because merchants could not have closed down on Saturday and stayed in business. One of Thomas Jefferson's distant successors in the White House was Jimmy Carter, who wore suits bearing the following label, Hart, Schaffner, and Marx, A. Cohen and Sons, America's Georgia. Perhaps Plains, Georgia was a little bit too tiny for an upscale men's clothing store. Elvis Presley, I think it's fair to say, dressed less conservatively than did President Carter. And in high school, to buy out, he went to, and while he was in high school, Presley went to the black section of Memphis to Lansky Brothers' store on Beale Street. And if Beale Street could talk, it would have revealed that pimps patronized Lansky Brothers. Bernie Lansky's standard greeting, hey man, what do you need today, led to the selection of Presley's outlandish clothes, establishing an image that endured even after the exhaustion of his career. Historians, of course, are never happier than when they can puncture myths and invalidate common beliefs. Revisionism is generally rewarded in the profession. But the impact of merchants in the southern Jewish past is too pronounced to be contested, and too important to be ignored and forgotten. If the Jewish Historical Society of South Carolina, if its Jewish Merchants Project is correct in defining a merchant as, quote, any individual selling goods, end of quote, then that category has embraced a huge swath of Southern Jewry. Not that other ways of making a living were spurned. After all, some famous Southern Jews did not become merchants. For the sake of the argument, let's confine ourselves to those with South Carolina connections. Judah B. Benjamin, Esquire, grew up in Charleston before becoming a plantation owner and a politician in Louisiana. Born in Camden, Bernard Baruch was a financier in New York City and a kibitzer in Washington, D.C. Ludwig Lewison, whom one cultural historian considers by far the most prominent Jewish writer in interwar America, became a novelist and a polemicist after graduating, as I'm sure everybody in this room knows, from the College of Charleston. Many boys grew up in the 1950s, President Rosenblum may well be one of them, who identified with Al Rosen, who was born in Spartanburg before becoming a star third baseman for the Cleveland Indians. And of course, as everyone in this room knows, in Charleston, Reuben Morris Greenberg served as police chief. Ben Sholem Bernanke grew up in Dillon before becoming a professor of economics at Princeton and chairing the Federal Reserve Board. Though not merchants, they too constituted a portion of the people. Some Southern Jews even became rabbis, even as the congregations that they served consisted largely of individuals selling goods. Comparison can suggest how peculiar this particular minority it was, especially roughly until the middle of the 20th century. Unlike other Southerners, Jews rarely tilled the soil. They didn't plant taters, they didn't plant cotton, and thus ensured that they would not be easily forgotten because their surnames were painted on the stores that dotted the region. Nor did Southern Jews, unlike co-religionists in cities elsewhere, start their lives enmeshed in the industrial working class. In the early 20th century, for example, 2 out of every 3 Jewish immigrants in New York City earned wages in the clothing industry. They were proletarians, for whom the New World was offered the betrayed promise of simply of toil in sweatshops. But in the same era, far more representative of the occupational patterns of East European Jews in the small towns of the South was, for example, the case of Lexington, Kentucky. And there, historian Lishai Weisbach has shown, of the 53 Russian or Polish-born Jewish heads of household identifiable in the 1920 census, they included 11 dry goods merchants, 10 clothing merchants, 7 proprietors of tailor shops, 3 owners of grocery or produce firms. Only a handful of the 53 Russian or Polish household heads in Lexington's Jewish community were employed in what might be considered atypical jobs for small town Jews. One was a barber, one a radiator repairman, one a mail clerk, one a simple laborer. And this top-heavy emphasis in commerce suggests that Lexington was simply not in any way an anomaly. In the mid-19th century, so many Jewish names were emblazoned on the storefronts of the main street of Tarboro, North Carolina, that the business district was nicknamed, quote, Little Jerusalem, end of quote. All the living Jews in that town for whom the U.S. Census could identify as having an occupation were either merchants or clerks who worked for those merchants. And of the 26 merchants in downtown Galveston, much earlier, 1866, 22 of them were Jews. They had moved into communities the Jews from the German states had already established, that is those who came in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. Professor Weisbach concluded that the arrival of East European immigrants did not profoundly transform the standard picture of small-town Southern Jewry, because the highly distinctive subculture that these newcomers established was a relatively short-lived phenomenon. That is, the Yiddish speakers from Eastern Europe failed to alter the entrepreneurial character of Jewish life in the small-town South. Neither of the two waves of immigration resulted in any imitation of the occupational pattern of other Southerners. And in differentiating themselves from their fellow citizens, Jews showed themselves to be less Southern, but also more American, more attuned to the economic aspects of American citizenship. And thus they validated the generalization of Alexis de Tocqueville, who asserted in 1840 that, quote, in democracies, nothing is greater or more brilliant than commerce. It attracts the attention of the public and fills the imagination of the multitude. All energetic passions are directed toward it, end of quote. And thus Tocqueville suggested that the cultivation of mercantile skills helps to distinguish a democratic society from an aristocratic one. And the triumph of the Union armies during the Civil War can be partly attributed to the economic downside of an agrarian order. Its devotion to patrician privilege and rigid tradition doomed the chances of succession that military valor could not overcome. And some postbellum Southerners therefore wanted to emulate the capitalist enterprise of the rest of the Union and indulge in visions of a prosperous New South after the Civil War. In 1866, for instance, a Richmond newspaper proposed an infallible test of the prospects of economic growth. Quote, where there are no Jews, there is no money to be made. And thus they would be targeted as the beneficiaries of Southern hospitality, so that according to historian Leonard Rogoff, Jewish newcomers, quote, could bring capital and commerce to an economically depressed agrarian society. And they came first, as again, I'm confident everybody in this room knows, they came first as peddlers. The peddlers can be readily categorized as distinctive. Not only were virtually all peddlers Jews, virtually all Jewish peddlers were first-generation Americans. And virtually all shopkeepers began their careers as peddlers, who were, in a sense, the acorns from which oaks sometimes grew. The startup expenses were small. Burdened with a pack, but with very little or no overhead, peddlers needed very little capital. Prizing independence, they did not have to endure intolerant or obnoxious bosses. Nor did peddlers face legal barriers to bringing their wares from one plantation or farm or town to another. The specter of anti-Semitism nevertheless hovered over them. A reputation for shady business practices invariably followed them from the old world. One credit report thus described a mercantile family in the South as about as, quote, trustworthy as it is possible for Jews to be, an exception to the race being that somebody was considered honest, end of quote. Such insinuations made it more than coincidental that the most famous episode of 19th century American anti-Semitism involved peddlers. That was when General Ulysses S. Grant expelled all Jews from the territory under his command. As commander of Union forces in the Department of Tennessee, he issued General Order No. 11 late in 1862, banning Jews from territory that encompassed Kentucky, plus parts of Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Missouri, as well as parts of Illinois. Lincoln immediately rescinded the order with Henry W. Halleck, General in Chief of the Union Armies, explaining to General Grant that the president did not object to, quote, expelling traitors and Jew peddlers, which I suppose was the object of your order, but as in terms prescribed for an entire religious class, some of whom were fighting in our ranks, the president deemed it necessary to revoke it, end of quote. Grant was no anti-Semite. His order merely reflected the conventional wisdom, which equated Jew peddlers with unscrupulous business practices like smuggling. As individuals selling goods on the road, in remote and often unfamiliar settings, the peddlers practiced a dangerous occupation. A few were murdered. Others were robbed. Many others simply failed. And their misfortune is usually now lost to historical retrieval, probably with only Dale able to retrieve it. It can never be done at all. The only person who's heroically able to do that. And it means that the failures, of course, basically are forgotten or lost to oblivion, so that perhaps only anecdotes can result as a substitute. Like the peddler who told a rural housewife that the cost of a paper fan that he wanted to sell her, that cost was 1 cent. The woman claimed that the price was too high. Okay, lady, came the reply, so make me an offer. Or take the case of the novelist Harry Cruz, who grew up in Bacon County, Georgia, who remembered a Jewish peddler who arrived in 1940, relatively late, dressed only in black. He relied on bartering, trading his thimbles and threads for cured meat or eggs or corn. He spoke only business, Cruz reports, having no capacity for pattern. Cruz could not remember anybody saying anything bad about him or anybody treating him badly, but he was different from the rest of us, end of quote. He was mysterious and nameless, as was the so-called Rolling Store Man, the moniker that the Georgia-born novelist Alice Walker, or Alice Walker's grandmother, bestowed on the Jewish peddler, who displayed his wares, spices most memorably, in the small cabin where Alice Walker's grandmother lived. Did either of these particular peddlers settle down and head families? Did either become a shopkeeper, as so many others did? Who knows? Not everyone made the transition to owning a store. But those who did could work within a network that included other Jews, who were merchants and wholesalers, all primed to provide goods to customers. But peddling was too grueling an ordeal to offer any inherent allure. It was temporary. The Jewish peddlers, Hosea Diner, the leading historian of Jewish peddlers, has written, "The Jewish peddlers had no desire to stay on the road. They saw such work as the fastest route to achieving economic security. They too wanted to put down roots and become respectable merchants and citizens. And for the vast majority," she added, "in fact, life on the road proved to be a short sentence, a brief stint before settling down," end of quote. A classic source of such a claim is William Alexander Percy's 1941 memoir of the Delta, a classic called Lanterns on the Levee, in which he recalled that with packs on their backs, peddlers from Russia, Poland, and Germany arrived in the Delta after the Civil War, selling trinkets to the freedmen and deferring gratification, so that enough profit could be squeezed and saved from such sales so that the peddlers can become merchants. And then William Alexander Percy reports, "Often the former peddlers and their sons became bankers, landowners, physicians, and attorneys." An assent that makes it tempting to declare that the only difference between a peddler and a professional is one generation. The Jews who came south found themselves in hamlets quite far from the gleaming alabaster cities that were undimmed by human tears, to quote from a late 19th century hymn. Relocation often occurred by caprice. In 1892, Simon Schiffman landed in Greensboro, North Carolina, where he was changing trains. He noticed that a jewelry store was up for sale, so he bought the jewelry store and never got it to Asheville, which is where he wanted to go. The historian Eli Evans once interviewed the first Jew to settle in a North Carolina village called Scotland Neck. And Evans asked him how he chose to open up a store there. The elderly interviewee explained, "The horse died." In a slightly fictionalized family history, Stella Suberman explained that her father ended up in a town that's she calls it Concordia in the book, in Tennessee. And he settled there precisely because it didn't have any Jews. The absence of competition encouraged him to open up a dry goods store there. On the other hand, Benjamin Boorstin propelled himself from the pale of settlement in the late 19th century and abruptly halted his quest for refuge in a town called Monroe, Georgia. His grandson, the Atlanta-born historian Daniel J. Boorstin, never found out why, although Benjamin Boorstin's brother arrived around the same time and opened up a competitive store directly across the street. Such retailers, the historian Oscar Hanlon commented, faced years of hard work and at most levels insecurity. One could say, in other words, that the pressures were formidable, the calculations of profit and loss verged always on the edge of precariousness. And if you think otherwise, recall that two U.S. presidents, Ulysses S. Grant and Harry S. Truman, both failed as retailers before they became presidents. But the field did offer certain benefits for Jews. A shop permitted a gentle adaptation to the New World, while giving Jews a shot at economic independence. A retailer, Oscar Hanlon added, also had the dignity of a man who could take time to observe the Sabbath, end of quote. Because many farmers could do their shopping in town only on Saturdays, his generalization about commercial freedom must nevertheless be modified, if not rejected. The day of rest basically had to be abandoned. Jews usually took it for granted the need to keep their stores open on the Jewish Sabbath. Variations can admittedly be found, and Charleston, I gather, is one of them. In the 1920s, for instance, a member of Brith Shalom Beth Israel in Charleston estimated that as many as 3/5 of the businesses that his congregants owned, fellow congregants owned, were closed on the Sabbath. But piety alone may not have accounted for their motivation. Their best customers worked in the Navy Yards and the phosphate factories and did not get paid until Saturday night anyway. Nor were Sunday blue laws widely enforced in Charleston, so that keeping the Sabbath did not directly conflict with making sales. Another advantage of retailing, Oscar Hanlon averred, was that Jews, quote, had the comfort of preserving the family structure. For these enterprises, in these enterprises, the families worked together, end of quote. Families arrived through chain migration, and they needed all hands on deck. The durability, the profitability of these businesses depended upon the dedication and the cohesiveness of families. The merchants typically succeeded because their relatives, not least their wives, were so involved in running the shops and in serving customers. Minding the store was the alternative to the desperation that often pervaded the southern countryside, which is why the habits of acquisitiveness could so easily thwart and distort other values. The scheming and greedy relatives on the maternal side of playwright Lillian Hellman's family inspired her to write The Little Foxes, for example. And in 1890, when no office of the president existed at the University of Virginia, W.W. Thornton chaired his faculty. The Jewish repudiation of the Savior continued to disturb Thornton. But Thornton was also disappointed that the university's Jewish students, quote, certainly care less for what is embraced in the term culture than Christians who were equally well off. They are immersed in business and money getting, end of quote. Such undergraduates presumably had businesses to inherit. And yet the continuity that could be synonymous with security and stability might also conflict with a dream of upward mobility. That is why, 8 decades after Thornton's observation, Eli Evans formulated the most famous sentence ever recorded about the Southern Jewish experience, which is often, quote, revolved around the fathers who built businesses for the sons who didn't want them, end of quote. Among them was Alan Lightman, who became a novelist and an MIT astrophysicist. His recent, partially fictionalized memoir recaps the career of his grandfather, Maurice Abraham Lightman, a civil engineer whose own father had immigrated from Hungary. In 1915, M.A. Lightman was working on a dam project in Alabama when he looked out of his hotel window and saw a long line of people waiting to get into a movie theater across the street. His grandson wrote that in those days of film, many movie theaters simply converted storefronts with a projector installed at the back of the room and folding chairs for the audience. Seeing that line of potential customers gave Lightman an idea. Sometimes the accident of geography could lead to opportunity. The following year, at the age of 25, he opened a movie theater in Sheffield, Alabama. Then came Florence, Alabama, and Nashville, and a decision to move his family from Nashville to Memphis. After the installation of sound equipment, beginning basically after 1927, Lightman created an empire of 63 movie palaces in 7 southern states, and he became the sole owner of a company called Malco. By the early 1930s, Lightman served as national president of the Motion Picture Theater Owners of America and became president of the Jewish Welfare Board in Memphis as well. Though Alan Lightman opted himself out of Malco, it enabled 4 generations to thrive, and Alan Lightman has written, most of my male relatives have worked in the empire, my father, 3 uncles, an occasional brother or 2, several cousins, and the children of cousins. Jews came to the South basically for 2 reasons, as this suggests, their families and the economy. And these phenomena were, of course, interconnected and interdependent. The intricate connections among families and friends that constituted ethnic networks encouraged Jews to concentrate in the niche sectors of the economy so that members of this tiny minority could easily and usually heavily deal simply with one another. Ethnic niches and kinship networks enabled many of the mainstream shopkeepers to survive and even to thrive. The trust that they were obliged to harbor for one another within that niche economy may well have given them a competitive edge. The peddlers crisscrossing the region often managed to achieve upward mobility in open stores and could then supply other peddlers with credit and goods. That trust seems only rarely to have been misplaced, because everyone in this niche economy could discern the benefits. Relatives loaned one another money, invested in one another's businesses, clerked in one another's stores, married into one another's families. Southern Jewry was, in Eli Evans's phrase, entwined like wisteria vines, end of quote. And so many kinfolks were installed in so many stores throughout the region that they provoked the question, why did God create Gentiles? Answer, somebody has to buy retail. Of course, many of those Gentiles were black, and Southern Jewish historiography has been paying enhanced attention to race relations, beginning, of course, with the peddlers themselves. Even before the Civil War, they seem to have demonstrated a willingness to cross the color line. They didn't want to make trouble, they merely wanted to make a sale. But perhaps that transcendent quest for customers made such Jews at least a bit subversive in the slave society that bore such an equivocal relationship to the capitalist ethos. Putting the South closer to what Tocqueville called the commercial passions pushed it a little bit further away from the rigidities of an embattled racial order. And therefore, the intrusion of Jewish tradesmen was bound to generate at least a little friction. Even the most famous antebellum visitor from the North, himself later a co-founder of the Nation magazine, was unsympathetic to these tradesmen. So that the eminent landscape architect Frederick Law Olmsted could not help noticing in the 1850s, quote, a swarm of Jews within the last 10 years that have settled in nearly every southern town, many of them of no character, opening cheap clothing and trinket shops, ruining or driving out of business many of the old retailers, and engaging in an unlawful trade with simple Negroes, which the Jews presumably found very profitable. Writing from as far away as Tsar's Russia, Fyodor Dostoevsky also caught the drift. Writing in 1877, he mentioned how Jews have already leaped en masse upon the millions of liberated Negroes in the American South and have already taken a grip upon them in the Jews' own way by means of their eternal gold pursuit and by taking advantage of the inexperience and vices of the exploited tribe. The Russian novelist added that although the Negroes have been liberated from the slave owners, this will not last because the Jews will grab at this new victim. Were these transactions exploitative? It's a loaded term and can neither be dismissed entirely nor casually accepted as true. Trade is supposed to benefit buyer and seller, but some Jewish merchants undoubtedly took advantage of caste privilege to cheat their black customers, who were in no position, of course, to complain or to secure a remedy. But the weight of evidence can nevertheless suggest that the benign features of these economic encounters also ought to be noted. The tradesman's faith that anyone alive should be considered a prospect reflected an admirable democratic spirit. To the villages and towns came Jews who were both temperate and moderate, largely immune to the unchecked emotion and spasms of violence that constituted the character ideal of the white southern male. Jews were more apt to regard former slaves and their descendants as customers, as debtors, and to place less weight upon their status as racial inferiors. Jews thus generated a larger clientele than did their white rivals. In the 1930s, for example, John Dollard reported again from Indianola that his Jewish merchants, quote, let the Negro know that his dollar is as good as anyone else's. Over and over, one hears from Negroes that Southern Gentile dry goods merchants have been crowded out of the territory because of their hostile categorical treatment of Negroes. Jewish shopkeepers, by contrast, quote, treated Negroes with courtesy, or at least without discourtesy, in strictly business relations. They find some way of avoiding the problem of Mr. and Mrs. by simply saying, what can I do for you, and letting it go at that. John Dollard also learned from his interviews that, quote, Jews bargain with Negroes and that Negroes like this. Other merchants are more likely to follow a strict one-price policy. Negro tenants get satisfaction out of the fact that Jewish merchants may allow themselves to be beaten, end of quote. In the Tennessee hometown of the historian Belle Wiley, the Jewish owner of the dry goods store, Wiley recalls, quote, got most of the black trade because he treated Negroes as human beings and was kindly to them, taking time to joke, inquire about their families, and otherwise manifest interest in them. The desperation of the Great Depression did narrow the gap between Jewish merchants and their competitors, who felt compelled to treat their black customers with greater politeness, a according to historian Clive Webb. But unlike other white businessmen, Jews extended such courtesies in times of economic boom as well as bust. So this offers at least some sense, in other words, that the Jews, Jewish merchants could well have been different in terms of they dealt with in dealing with race relations. But from a black perspective, the transition from peddling to, quote, the Jew store may well have been a setback. Many blacks welcomed the Jewish peddler not because he treated them with courtesy, but because he provided a certain degree of freedom in shopping. With peddlers, black customers didn't have to stand in line waiting until all white customers had been helped to get the attention of a clerk. They didn't have to put up with their frequently intimidating presence and the glaring eyes of other whites. From a black perspective, the transition from the small dry goods store to urban department stores may well have been a setback too. In such department stores, blacks could even be more subjected to mistreatment. The restrooms, the water fountains, the restaurants were of course subject to Jim Crow, if segregated restrooms existed at all. Nor were black clerks generally hired. Even as late as the mid-20th century in Baltimore, located, of course, in a former slave state that had not seceded from the Union, the Jewish-owned department stores did not permit black customers to try on clothes, nor to be seated at lunch counters, nor to be extended credit, nor to return what they had purchased, despite, of course, the familiar promise of satisfaction guaranteed. In any event, Jewish merchants sometimes attracted the same enemies that Southern blacks did. In the 1920s and 1930s, the second iteration of the Ku Klux Klan adopted the distinctive wardrobe that actors had used in D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, released first in 1915. And some Jewish merchants discerned an opportunity as a result. So that, for example, in the iconic novel by Harper Lee, evoking Macomb, Alabama after the First World War, Atticus Finch recalls the Klan as an outfit that, quote, couldn't find anybody to scare. They paraded by Mr. Sam Levy's house one night, but Sam just stood in his porch and told him things had come to a pretty pass. He'd sold them the very sheets on their backs. Sam made them so ashamed of themselves, they went away. Or take Richard Kluger's novel, Members of the Tribe, published in 1977, a fictionalized account of the lynching of Leo Frank. And it too alludes to the same commercial instinct that To Kill a Mockingbird does. Kluger's main character, Noah Berkowitz, changes his name to Berg in Coming to Georgia, and he marries Naomi Klein, whose family sold sheets throughout the state to the Ku Klux Klan. Steve Stern extends some interactions into a more elaborate joke in his most recent novel set in the noticeably Jewish neighborhood of Memphis, known as The Pinch. There, several Jewish merchants and a tailor find themselves facing a street march of Klansmen who, according to Stern's account, decked out in their Halloween finest, white robes and pointed hoods. The Jews of The Pinch do not cower or flee. Instead, they compete not only in figuring out who their customers are, but also which one of them bought the fabrics classier than mere schmatas. Such evidence is, of course, fictional, and even when presented as oral history, may be apocryphal. Nevertheless, it seems to be evident in 1921, when a Claiborne marched for the first time in Houston, a Jewish merchant is reported to have sold the members their robes and sheets. Mississippi's Forest County is named for the founder of the first Klan, General Nathan Bedford Forrest. Hattiesburg is located there, and in that town, the father of Dottie London Stettleman watched Klan parades. The father could recognize the men by the shoes he had sold them. He could see their shoes under their sheets. An elderly Jew in Alabama once assured Eli Evans of what excellent customers the Klansmen were. "I used to sell them sheets, and Sam the tailor made them into robes. Let me tell you, we had a good business going." But let's note, of course, what has already been noted by a previous speaker, which is to say this is a story that also, to a large extent, comes to an end. And that is the sense, in other words, that these stores, certainly in the small towns, would have a history but not much of a present. Nevertheless, there is something to be said about what they achieved, both in the small towns and in the cities. Perhaps the most important effect I think one could look at historically was that it accelerated the process of modernization, of which the key components are secularism and consumerism. The balance sheets of the urban department stores should therefore be interpreted as the death warrant of the traditional order. Jewish merchants played a role in what Max Weber called the disenchantment of the world. When a department store magnate like Jacob Goldsmith originates the Spirit of Christmas parade in Memphis, when more than 100,000 residents of Atlanta regularly attend the annual lighting of the great Christmas tree at Rich's department store, something has happened to the exclusivity of a religious holiday celebrated in what has historically been the most Protestant part of the Western Hemisphere. Already during the Civil War, a children's book published in Macon, Georgia, depicted a little boy dreaming before Christmas of, quote, all the curious things he had seen in a Jew's shop the day before, end of quote. So that in a region locked in agrarian habits of mind and conduct, the counterlife of the Jewish merchants thus helped to cultivate a taste for the products of the industrialized world. And in helping to modernize the South, in making it less devout, Jewish businessmen altered the cultural climate that everyone breathed. Secularization and consumerism thus constitute the historic achievement of the Jew stores and of the flagship department stores that anchored the urbanization of the region. Hence, the merchants who prospered there softened the buccaneer capitalism that is so often associated with the robber barons of the 19th century. William H. Vanderbilt notoriously dismissed objections to his way of doing business by remarking, "The public be damned." The Jewish merchants who operated near Vanderbilt University and not only in Nashville adopted a very different credo, "The public be pleased." The decline of the economic niche of the Southern Jews, associated with at least a century ago, of course has many causes. The competition of mail order companies such as Sears Roebuck made the brick and mortar stores less integral to the local economy. Though they continued to attract customers, they began vanishing along with the yeomanry who once shopped in them. The Department of Agriculture still exists because farmers remain politically influential. But statistically, they have become insignificant. Mechanical cotton pickers eliminated the need for cheap labor, and the men and women who once picked cotton often migrated to the western and northern cities. Competition from behemoths like Walmart and Amazon slammed the last nails into the coffins of the general stores that had once flourished in the crossroads south. The occasional news stories about the fate of tiny Jewish communities have not pretended that they will enjoy a robust future, but have instead tried to give these saving remnants the dignity of a decent burial. Nor should the sentence that Eli Evans basically made so resonant about the sons repudiating the businesses that their fathers had built, that explanation cannot be forgotten either. No such assertion, no single sentence can ever cover everything. And it's obvious, of course, that even his sentence omits the half of Southern Jewry that has been composed of women who were presumed for much of Southern Jewish history to be ineligible to inherit the ownership of stores. Nevertheless, Evans did capture a central feature of Southern Jewish history. When the region was primarily rural and small town, before the impact of urbanization and suburbanization could fully register, but no generalization can do justice to the full span of the richness of Southern Jewish life from the 18th century to the present, from the sparse and fragile settlements of the colonial era to the wealthy enclaves of Miami-Dade County today. Such statements cannot account for the sheer variety of the occupations that Southern Jewish men and women have held. Perhaps most intriguingly, his generalization leaves open for investigation what happened to the generation that enjoyed the freedom to skip the careers in business? What was the fate of those who resisted the appeal of merchandising and who moved elsewhere? The answers are bound to be sketchy, But look what happened to one particular town in Louisiana. While Jewish merchants once dominated the main street of downtown New Iberia, its two historians have noted, no Jewish-operated retail businesses remain. Instead, Jews in New Iberia and the surrounding area are most likely doctors, lawyers, professors at the University of Louisiana in nearby Lafayette. In other words, such changes occurred throughout the region as the progeny of businessmen entered the professions or pursued the arts. And the result was often an enlargement of the nation's civic life and the enhancement of America's cultural life. The list would begin certainly with Ludwig Lewison, who was born in Berlin, arrived in St. Matthew, South Carolina, and was to become a key American writer, again, as I mentioned, in the interwar period. Born in Uniontown, Alabama, Morris Ernst, who was the son of a peddler, who had immigrated from Bohemia and would join his older brother in running a general store. Next to his family, Morris Ernst recalled, business was his father's greatest joy in Uniontown. His mother, the daughter of immigrants, was unusual in having a degree from Hunter College, but Ernst became a leading civil liberties attorney who won the Ulysses case in 1933 and later served on President Truman's Civil Rights Commission. Elliot Cohen was raised in Mobile, where his father owned a dry goods store, but entered Yale College at the age of 15, became a founder of the American Jewish Committee-sponsored Commentary magazine, which ranks among the most influential magazines in all of Jewish history. Ben Bernanke's father was a pharmacist and a part-time theater manager in Dillon, sent his son to Camp Blue Star in Hendersonville, North Carolina. Born in Charleston, the songwriter Arthur Freed became a producer who ran the musical unit of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer in its most glorious two decades from 1939 to 1959. And I can't help adding that Louis B. Mayer put so many of his own relatives on the payroll of the studio that the initials MGM were said to stand for Mayer's ganze Mishpacha. which gets us to Stanley Donen, born in 1924, died almost exactly 3 months ago. Let me end with this consideration of Eli Evans's generalization, ending with a Hollywood director whose Oscar in 1998 cited him for a body of work marked by grace, elegance, wit, and visual innovation, end of quote. Stanley Donen's father was Mordecai Moses Donen, who managed a chain store that sold mid-range dresses. His mother was the former Helen Cohen. They lived in Columbia, South Carolina, where his parents gave him cameras with which he experimented. Donen recalled, the camera was like a constant companion. It allowed me to withdraw into myself, especially, he noted, when faced with the anti-Semitism of young bullies. He found growing up in Columbia in the interwar period awful. He said, I hated growing up there and couldn't wait to get out, end of quote. Luckily, Donen's father had to visit the company's home office in New York during the summers, and his son joined him. There, he attended dance school as well as numerous Broadway musicals. In 1940, after graduating from high school at the age of 16, Donen spent a semester studying psychology at the University of South Carolina, a field he pursued only to please his father. But then Donen fled to New York, where he became a dancer, a choreographer, and then a director. His credits include Singin' in the Rain, which he co-directed, Arthur Freed, born in Charleston, who wrote most of the lyrics, produced what may be the most admired Hollywood musical ever made. Another of Donen's hits was Damn Yankees, 1958, which he also co-directed. The title does not suggest the regional hostility between the blue and the gray, but instead the dynasty of an American League baseball team, which those of us from Boston don't mention. Donen's other credits include On the Town, which he co-directed and which boasted a score by Leonard Bernstein. In Boston, the composer's father owned a beauty shop supply business, which he would have been happy to pass on to his son. And even after Leonard Bernstein had come to personify American music, Samuel Bernstein assured him that there would always be a place for him in the beauty shop supply business. Donen lived a full life, undoubtedly fuller than he had sold dresses in South Carolina. That life included so many wives, five, all of whom divorced him, that his living room included a cushion embroidered with the words, eat, drink, and remarry. To recap such careers is to corroborate the role of Southern Jews, the merchants, and their descendants in making not only the South, but even the rest of the nation modern. Their inventiveness and their innovativeness, their resourcefulness and their resilience, brought a little closer to realization the tantalizing promise issued by Thomas Jefferson of an inalienable right to pursue happiness. Through some combination of savvy and industriousness, good timing, and a willingness to take calculated risks, these business people therefore merit retrospective praise for making the South less impoverished, and of course, not only materially. So I just wonder if it's overstatement to suggest that such Jews helped foster the ideals of equality and autonomy that represent the elusive axial principles of American society. Thanks very much.
Steve, thank you so much. We do have a number of minutes for some questions, if we have questions for Professor Whitfield. Questions, comments?
Mr. Robert, Rosen, yeah,
tell me more about Freed. I never...
This is what I'm afraid of when I come to Charleston. First of all, you're in the audience. Secondly, you caught me with a little bit of cheating here, for which I should be grateful. He was indeed born in Charleston. His father was, and you may know more about this certainly than I do, his father was not somebody who sold shoes or clothes or notions.
Who are we talking
He was
about?
An art merchant. His first name was Max. So Max Fried, F-R-E-E-D. Mm-hmm. But Max Fried and his wife left Charleston when Freed was still relatively young. I have a feeling, and this is where you've caught me, I have a feeling that Arthur Freed was still in his age in terms of the single digits. So he actually grew up in Seattle. Although technically I'm correct, he is from Charleston. And it's still remarkable that a movie like Singin' in the Rain involved the behind-the-screen talent of two people who were from South Carolina who were Jews, and that's Arthur Freed and Sandy Duncan. Quite peculiar.
Steve, I think
I'm sorry, you had another?
Okay. I just want to tell you, I think Freed is in our Mac and Jewish Charleston project.
Oh.
We've got photographs.
Oh, fantastic. Of Max Freed.
Yeah, but we mentioned Arthur.
Oh.
We claim him.
Okay.
So there.
Damn, why am I not surprised?
Christian?
Hi, I'm not from the South, and I think my question's going to give that away from D.C. I was very curious to hear more about your discussion of Jewish relationships to the KKK and the idea that they were actually selling them sheets and making their robes. What was that relationship, and what does that say about Jewishness in the South? Were they not implicated in their agenda because of their whiteness, or what does that mean?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll try to be as brief as possible, because first of all, historians believe, either three or four Ku Klux Klans. There was the Klan immediately after the Civil War, the Reconstruction period, in which the first Ku Klux Klan, co-founded, depends on who you read on this, co-founded by General Nathan Bedford Forrest, that obviously wanted to put the newly freed slaves back in their place to subject them to roughly the same conditions of slavery, even though they were technically free. The first Klan, with some small exceptions, was not anti-Jewish. Its sole purpose was race and racial subjugation. And there's an extraordinary passage in Bernard Baruch's autobiography called My Story, in which he and a cousin find a robe of the Ku Klux Klan in their family heirloom. And that was Simon Baruch's father, that is the grandfather of Bernard Baruch. So it was not at all impossible in the first Klan to even be Jewish. And it was, of course, fundamentally very, very violent. The second Klan was violent, much less so. And the second Klan was basically about restoring, I hate to say this, but somehow making America great again, in terms of ending the impact that immigration was to have. Immigration closes in 1924 in terms of European immigration, in terms of establishment of quota systems. And the aim was to restore a kind of racial purity. It was fundamentally Protestant. Its targets were Catholicism, Jews, and blacks. But it was not distinctively Southern, which was true of the first Klan. It was more powerful in the Midwest and in places like Oklahoma than it ever was in the Deep South. And believe it or not, the chief victims of the second Klan were other white Protestants who had violated norms of marital fidelity and so on. The third Klan is probably at least as anti-Semitic, it emerges in the 1950s, at least as anti-Semitic as it is anti-black. The fourth Klan is into many, many different versions of it, but clearly the anti-Semitic component, the white identity component, is also very strong. And Jews, at least in the second Klan, as the limited evidence I've provided suggests, Jews were not necessarily fearful that violence would be directed against them. And it was in some ways simply a symbolic assertion or reassertion of a kind of homogeneous white Protestant identity. Mark, you're calling.
Naomi?
There's an older gentleman that I visit who grew up in Newbury, North Carolina, and started a plywood business. A lot of you probably know his name, Jack Kurtz. And so I talked to him very often, and he was saying that the merchants, people would just come down and they'd find an empty store and set up. But my question, I guess, is, he said that there was only one place in Baltimore that would sell them goods, that it was a kind of an anti-Semitic thing that nobody would sell them anything. So I was just curious what your comment was on how they got the stuff that they peddled or sold.
Oh, so not specifically about Baltimore.
No, he said that his father had owned a store, and he just found an empty space, and that they were selling dry goods and clothing, but that the only place they would sell them goods was a Jewish merchant in Baltimore who would sell to other Jews, that it was difficult for the Jews to actually
It may well have happened, but it contradicts what we seem to know about peddlers, which is to say, the peddler is, again, overwhelmingly Jewish, overwhelmingly first generation, would basically get their goods and their credit from ex-peddlers who were Jews. And that these were credit networks that depended, as I mentioned briefly, that really depended upon notions of trust, and that did not have to depend outside of their own ethnic group to get the credit or to get the goods. You know, the problem with history is that you could always find some oddity, some anomaly, some exceptions. But generally speaking, what you're describing flies against what we seem to know about how the peddlers were able to get their goods. And it would often involve a week on the road to come back, and usually by Friday or certainly by Saturday, have time if they had a family, and then go on the road again with another pack on Monday or Sunday.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm Stanley Young's sister, and I want to take Geisha about the wives.
The wives, sorry.
He divorced them.
Fair enough. Have to stay correct.
Any other question? Steve?
I wonder how much of the story, I never heard the story of the shoes before except in my family, So I wonder how much of this is in the pocketbook. But I was probably, you know, this was 60 years ago, I heard the story about my grandfather closing his door in St. Matthews when there was a Klan march. And standing out the front and all the way down there when it closed. And the same thing, as they marched by, he could see who's, he knew who they were by the way. Someone would say, oh, this was that. Is that probably because the story I heard as a child?
Yes. Same, it's probably true. Again, it's one of the oddities of anti-Semitism that has been looked at particularly in the United States, in which there may be a kind of abstract anti-Semitism, an abstract hostility drawn almost certainly largely from Christian mythology, by which the Jews are to be condemned for having repudiated Jesus, for denying Christ as the Savior, and so on. And that is often contradicted by their interactions with actual Jews. So one of the paradoxes of American anti-Semitism, and certainly of Southern anti-Semitism, is some, in one part of their heads, Jews are targets of hostility, but not the Jew next door is going to be made into an exception. And believe it or not, that also seems to have been the case even with some Nazis.
Yeah, that's true.
So that even an ideology that sees Jews as metaphysically evil and worthy of extermination, on one case, and I had to mention the name, even Heinrich Himmler said at one point that he was always disturbed by the fact that even some of the people in the SS said that there are seemingly some good Jews that are to be treated differently. Not in practice, but at least in theory. So American anti-Semitism and Southern anti-Semitism has that component. So what you're saying is whether or not it's apocryphal, at least it's extremely plausible.
Dale.
Steve, I have to ask the Mark Bauman question. Is there anything distinctively Southern in the story you're telling? Was it the same in the Midwest, in upstate New York?
Yeah. My guess would be, and it's strictly a guess, but the answer would be no. That is, one would have to look at, it seems to me, the most salient features of what makes the South different. It could have been historically its agrarianism. It could have been historically its militarism. It could be historically the relative absence of cities and of industries. As I mentioned, it's the most thoroughly Protestant part, not just of the United States, but of the whole Western Hemisphere. And that might have in some ways tinctured relations that Jewish merchants had with their customers, white and black, that might have been a little bit different. The only thing that would be different, I think, that I again tried to suggest was if it's true that broadly speaking, the relations that Jewish merchants had with black customers were basically benign, that would suggest that Jewish merchants played a role in the evolution of Southern history that would have been clearly different from the Midwest and the Far West and New England. There were peddlers in all parts of the U.S. that were Jews. But here, I think, in the South, one might say that they gave a certain push toward a less malign and a less violent version of race relations by the ways by which they prioritized sales and finding customers that would not be judged merely by the color of their skin. It's the closest I could get, but even that, I would have to say, Dale, is a very tentative kind of claim. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Steve. I think this may be a historical society first. We are, in fact, ahead of schedule. And so I'll thank Steve both for setting us up for our next panel discussion, which begins in in just about 25 minutes or so. And so what I'll tell you is that we'll take a 10 or 15 minute break, and we'll count on that taking about 20 or 25 minutes. So please do feel free to take a walk outside, finish up some of the food that we have out in the hall, and we'll see you back in here in about 20 minutes.